Western Sahara. We just have a minute, but if you can respond to the significance of the South African ambassador hosting this. I also testified because Democracy Now! Is the last journalist to get into Western Sahara, and we did a documentary called 4 Days in Western Sahara, Africa's Last Colony. What people are calling for here?
They're calling for respect for human rights of the people of Western Sahara. They're calling for the UN to have a monitoring system, human rights monitoring system, which they do not in Western Sahara. They're calling for a chance to have a referendum on self-determination for Sahrawis to decide their future. They've been waiting for over 30 years for this. And
the significance of this side panel hearing?
It's important to have also South Africa supporting the Sahrawi people. South Africa is a long-time supporter of liberation movements around the world, and it has always been on the side of the Sahrawi people.
We'll be doing more on this, and Pekun can check out the documentary, 4 Days in Western Sahara, Africa's Last Colony, at democracynow.org. Maria Carrion, thank you so much. Back to you, Nermeen, in New York.
And that does it for the show. I'm Nermeen Sheikh with Amy Goodman for another edition of Democracy Now! Special thanks to Poon Echevarri, Romain, and François in Geneva. And a very happy birthday to Isis Phillips. We're hiring for multiple positions. Please see democracynow.org jobs.
You are tuned into KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
Do you like discovering new music and reconnecting with some older but perhaps forgotten favorites? Then look no further. Tune into The Listening Room with host Timothy P. every other Thursday at 3 in the morning for a genre-bending 2.5-hour show where you never know what you might hear next, but you will be sure to be engaged and entertained.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Southeast Portland just had a parallel parking competition.
The Oregon legislative session for 2025 ended last Friday.
And the fire department is getting ready for the 4th of July holiday.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, June 30th, 2025. I'm Terrence Burns.
And I'm Dave Johnson. Amateur use of fireworks is a polarizing topic. Every Independence Day, many people set off fireworks in unregulated circumstances, saying it's a fun way to better enjoy the holiday. Others think home fireworks are dangerous and represent a major disturbance, especially to pets and wildlife. Regardless, fireworks season is currently underway in Oregon. The annual 14-day legal fireworks purchasing period started on June 23rd. Fireworks can be legally purchased statewide until July 6th, but many cities and or agencies impose tight restrictions on their sale and use in hopes to prevent the risk of accidental fires and injuries. The Oregon State Fire Marshal is promoting the message, quote, keep it legal, keep it safe. The agency also reminds Oregonians to practice the 4 B's of safe fireworks use. Number one, be prepared. Have a bucket of water or hose nearby. Number two, be safe. Keep children and pets at a safe distance. Never light fireworks near dry vegetation. Number three, be responsible. Don't relight duds after lighting a firework. Soak them in water before disposing. And finally, number four, be aware. Only use legal fireworks and only where they are allowed. In Oregon, legal fireworks must remain within 12 inches of the ground. If they travel higher than a foot into the air, they require a permit. That means popular fireworks like bottle rockets and Roman candles are illegal. Violators can face a Class B misdemeanor and fined of up to $2,500. In addition, fireworks are not allowed in many locations across the state, including public lands and parks, national parks and forests, Bureau of Land Management property, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service properties, Oregon State beaches, parks, and campgrounds, and the coastal shore. Officials are particularly worried about the fire risk. As of the end of June, Oregon State has already closed or evacuated three state parks due to nearby wildfires. Firework usage may also pose a danger to protected species disturbed by the loud noise of explosives. Waste is also a concern. Last year, volunteers near Lincoln City collected nearly 1,000 pounds of trash after the holiday, with firework mess making up a huge chunk of the debris. The Portland Fire Bureau reminds residents that fireworks are illegal within city limits. Similar year-round bans are in effect across cities including Eugene, Milwaukee, the Dalles, and numerous other densely populated areas.
Residents of Southeast Portland's Buckham neighborhood put their parallel parking skills to the test Saturday for the coveted spray-painted Golden Subaru Trophy. Saturday's competition started slowly at the corner of Southeast Pine Street and 29th Avenue, with pool noodles affixed to bumpers and chalk marks carefully placed on the asphalt and curb. Within an hour, a lineup of cars wanted their turn, while a small crowd of neighborhood spectators looked on with nervous curiosity. Contest organizers, Daniel Lyman and his husband Casey Schreiner, announced their quote-unquote friendly competition on social media late last week to a curious public audience. Schreiner, who wore a neon safety vest and waved a printed paper copy of the official competition rules, directed local traffic and encouraged drivers as they waited for their turn to compete. Schreiner said, quote, "This is a really fun turnout, and it's great to have people cheering folks on. This is definitely in that spirit of keeping Portland weird," end quote. Contest organizers, Stephanie Lynch, said that she's familiar with a similar competition through a friend in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Stephanie says that she and fellow event organizer Daniel, quote, "have a history of egging each other on in very stupid ways, so it felt like perfect timing," end quote. Event participant David Cano explained that he'd heard about the competition from a friend. He went on to say that he grew up in San Francisco. He had many an opportunity to squeeze his car into a tight spot. He went on to say, quote, "It was a lot more nerve-wracking than I initially anticipated. Honestly, it felt great out there. It's wonderful having people cheer you on," end quote. Cano suggested, "Next year's competition could include left-side parallel parking. That's a real challenge." This story references an article written by Joni Audenland and published by OPB.
The Oregon Department of Transportation is facing immediate mass layoffs. The Oregon legislative session ended last week without providing millions more for the department. A transportation bill headed by Democrats was originally a $12 billion spending bill that would have increased taxes on gas and made vehicle title and registration more expensive to pay for infrastructure and public transit costs. A scaled-down version was also proposed and shot down over concerns of taxes. Republicans celebrated the defeat of the bill, calling it one of the largest tax hikes in Oregon state history. But as a result, up to 700 jobs are expected to be cut before the end of July. Governor Tina Kotek has 30 days to sign those bills into law. Kotek can call lawmakers back into session.
Last week, the Community and Public Safety Committee held a meeting devoting an hour to presentation on Oregon's Sanctuary Promise. The committee, attended by Councilors Samir Kanal and Angelita Murillo and Steve Novick, convicted on June 24th of last week. Councilor Kanal says that he's hoping to start the conversation on ICE, aka Immigration and Customs Enforcement, operations in Portland. The committee facilitated and presentation on the sanctuary city status. Chief Deputy City Attorney Heidi Brown gave the presentation about what the sanctuary city policy in Portland. Brown explains that the city prohibits the use of city funds, personnel, or equipment to enforce federal immigration law. The Portland Code states that PPB shall not cooperate with ICE as expressively required by federal law. Police Chief Bob Day outlines some of these expectations and the ways that PPB is currently interacting with ICE. Police Chief Bob Day presented on what the Portland Police Bureau's directive is concerning cooperating with ICE means. Vast majority federal communications are with FPS, Federal Protective Services, but they are not ICE agents. They are FPS. Department of Homeland Security, Border Patrol, and the state and city laws rely ICE, really concern ICE. Chief Day has communicated with all of them. The activity that is directly involved in concern criminal behavior that would be applicable anywhere not regarding immigration status. Counselor Canal acknowledged the permits to revoke ICE's permit to operate the facility in McAdam in southwest Portland. But he says, quote, this permit issue is not entirely within the community's jurisdiction. Canal suggests that other committees, perhaps the Climate and Land Use Committee of the Transportation and Infrastructure Committee, might be better equipped to address this petition. Councilor Canal says that he wants to get the conversation going as soon as possible. Even though there was no time for public comment during the meeting, and he knew that would be frustrating for many Portlanders. Canal mentioned that they plan on having further conversation on July 8th, the 15th, and 22nd. Canal says in a very carefully worded introduction, the conversation, quote, we are as much having the federal imposition occur to us in city government, and we are trying to find the best way to respond to it, end quote.
Oregon programs that create resilience in the face of climate change and extreme weather have been dealt a blow in the new state budget. Climate justice advocates say by cutting programs that fund emergency cooling centers, among others, the state is falling behind in its climate goals. Isabel Charlet has more on the story.
Oregon's new state budget cuts funding for programs that protect residents from extreme weather and make renewable energy more accessible. Climate justice advocates say it's a major setback after years of progressive climate policies. Ben Brint of the Oregon Environmental Council is disappointed to lose funding for the Community Renewable Energy Program, which supports a variety of projects tailored to communities, including microgrids and solar storage.
We felt legislators didn't fund climate resilience programs while fires are raging, people's houses are burning down, and the state has already experienced record heat waves in June. Legislators don't see we are in an actual climate emergency and chose inaction.
Brint says CREP aimed to help low-income rural and communities of color, those most impacted by climate disasters. Lawmakers attribute the cuts to budget shortfalls and uncertainty over federal funding. Joel Eboa of the Oregon Just Transition Alliance says the Community Resilience Hub program, which creates networks as well as physical places to protect people from extreme cold, heat, and smoke, also lost funding this session. He says the hubs are effective because communities design them to meet their unique needs.
Whether it be a place to plug in your phone, or a place to go get diapers, or get an air conditioner, whatever your community may need depending on what's going on.
A heat pump rental program aimed at making energy-efficient heating and cooling more affordable was also cut this session. Brint says he realizes legislators have to make tough decisions about how to fund healthcare and housing, but he emphasizes climate change is connected to those issues.
When we're talking about heat pumps or the CREP program, we're talking about people's health and livelihoods and saving lives in the face of climate-fueled disaster.
Brint adds, since climate change is not going away, the movement to push for climate resilience won't either. I'm Isabel Charlet, Oregon News Service.
The Senate narrowly advances Trump's budget banca bill, despite procedural issues. Democrats demand answers about the decision to bomb Iran's nuclear sites, and Health Secretary RFK Jr. is changing how vaccines are evaluated. With that story and more, it's Alex Gonzalez with the 2025 Talks.
Welcome to 2025 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
I think everyone in the House, they know the peril they're in if they vote no on this thing.
Texas Congressman Michael McCaul says President Donald Trump's One Big Beautiful Bill is great, but also warns fellow Republicans their jobs depend on its success. Senate Republicans narrowly voted to start debate on the mega bill Saturday evening. Tennessee's Rand Paul voted no over raising the debt limit by $5 trillion, and North Carolina's Tom Tillis said he won't support cutting $40 trillion for Medicaid in his state. Tillis said Sunday he won't seek re-election. Democrats say Majority Leader John Thune broke Senate rules. They say after promising not to, he ignored a parliamentarian's ruling that the Medicaid and SNAP cuts to pay for the tax cuts for the wealthy are subject to filibuster. And Virginia's Mark Warner says they're massively unpopular.
It's not over till it's over. I will grant that President Trump has been able to hold his party in line in an unprecedented manner. At the other end, this bill will come back and bite them.
Trump is demanding he get to sign the bill on the 4th of July, but hurdles remain in both closely divided chambers. House Democrats say they're not satisfied with administration explanations for bombing three nuclear sites in Iran. The extent of the damage is still being debated, and UN nuclear watchdog Rafael Grossi says he thinks Tehran could restart enriching uranium in a matter of months, not decades, as Trump has said. A Supreme Court ruling on presidential power will let Trump's ban on citizenship for babies with foreign-born parents go into effect, but only in states that failed to sue over it. California Attorney General Rob Bonta did sue and says he expects to win.
I'm hopeful that the court will see that a patchwork of state injunctions where birthright citizenship stands for some states but not others would inevitably create administrative chaos and spur questions we don't have the answers to.
The court didn't overrule the standard view that the 14th Amendment grants citizenship to any child born on American soil, except for special cases like diplomats' kids. The court did limit federal courts' ability to block presidential orders. During confirmation, Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. said he wouldn't undermine vaccines. But last week, he empowered agency advisors, including vaccination skeptics, to rewrite inoculation recommendations, even on shots used for years. Doctors say they're alarmed that the panel voted to withdraw support for many flu vaccines due to a debunked theory about the preservative thimerosal. A three-part online training on how to run for office and govern well starts tonight. The Grassroots Democracy Program from the Western Organization of Resource Councils aims to increase effective political engagement in Western states, and Gwen LeCult says they expect lots of questions.
Everything from, am I ready to run for office? How do I organize my campaign? To how do I govern? And how can I be an effective elected official?
I'm Alex Gonzalez for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. We'd like to remind you that you can renew your KBOO membership or become a member at any time during this program by going online to kboo.fm/give. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report from Ken Jones, who speaks with author Carolyn Dasher about her book released tomorrow, July 1st. At 6, it's Labor Radio. At 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. Then at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be clear with an overnight low in the low 60s. Tomorrow, expect nothing but sunshine with a daytime high near 88 degrees. Currently, it's 89. Today in history, the first leap second was added to Coordinated Universal Time to account for Earth's slowing rotation. The quote of the day is from Dr. Seuss, who said, "Today you are you. That is truer than true. There is no one alive who is youer than you."
The moon above is yours and mine. The right to fall in love is yours and mine. The hope of finding the dreams our hearts desire.
Ontario Premier Doug Ford has apologized to Indigenous leaders for comments that some of the First Nations described as racist. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Ontario Premier Doug Ford has apologized to Indigenous leaders for comments that some First Nations described as racist. The comments were sparked by opposition to Bill 5, which would allow his government to bypass environmental and other regulations in order to fast-track resource development in special economic zones. Dan Karpinchuk has more.
Native leaders have opposed Bill 5, which would, among other things, fast-track mining approvals for critical minerals. Last week, Premier Doug Ford appeared frustrated by their opposition.
You can't just keep coming hat in hand all the time to the government. You got to be able to take care of yourselves.
Ford had also said his government was making an offer to First Nations on, quote, a silver platter, and that he had treated them like gold. But his language didn't sit well with most Indigenous leaders. Saul Mamakwa is the only First Nations member of the Ontario legislature.
Those comments that were very deeply troubling, but also racist. As First Nations, we are not beggars.
During a two-hour meeting with the Indigenous leaders, Ford apologized.
And I just want to say I sincerely apologize for my words, not only if it hurt all the chiefs in that room, but all First Nations. And I get passionate because I want prosperity for their communities.
Speaking for the Native leaders, Anishinaabeg Nation Grand Council Chief Linda DeBasigi.
Our chiefs felt today that the apology was sincere. We are looking at today as a new day going forward.
DeBasigi says the meeting was not about Bill 5, but about the Ontario government upholding its treaty responsibility. She did say Native leaders are still opposed to Bill 5. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
It's the last day of Pride Month, an observance to celebrate the LGBTQ community. KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazio has more on a Two-Spirit Navajo jurist.
Born in Lupton on the Navajo Nation, Maricopa County's first Indigenous Justice of the Peace, Deborah Ann Begay, has been ruling out of the Moon Valley Courthouse in North Phoenix since 2020. The Navy veteran attended UC Berkeley, then law school at ASU. She's a single parent who identifies as Two-Spirit. And Begay says the best part of her job is officiating marriages, especially for same-sex couples.
Doing the ceremony, you're performing a like professional function, but yet you're kind of included in their private lives. And that's even more so when I would get invited to their personal homes.
Despite the U.S. Supreme Court legalizing those unions in a 2015 landmark decision, they are still not recognized by the Navajo Nation. The Dene'ina Marriage Act defines matrimony as being only between a man and a woman, though there's been recent pushback to repeal that law. I'm Gabriel Pietrazio.
In 1847, members of the Choctaw Nation donated $170 to victims of the Irish famine, a gift that keeps on giving. As Show McPolin reports, a new festival is bringing Indigenous and Irish people together again.
It's been 10 years since the Kindred Spirit sculpture was installed in the Irish county of Cork. From the 20-foot-tall stainless steel feathers, which commemorate the Choctaw donation, a new organization emerged. Kindred Spirits Ireland is hosting the World Peace Gathering this summer for those who wish to, quote, celebrate peace, healing, cultural exchange, and Indigenous wisdom. Featured guests include former Navajo Nation Attorney General Ethel Branch and Chief Phil Lane Jr. Sensei Stephen Segal, who claims DNA connections to Indigenous Yakut and Buryat heritage, was also just added to the lineup. For National Native News, I'm Sho McPolin in Ireland.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Deaths from fentanyl and opioids in Washington State's Native American communities have risen sharply since the pandemic, even as the rest of the country has seen a downturn. The state's Tribal Opioid Fentanyl Task Force says investing in more treatment centers and transitional housing will help. Isabel Shirley has more on the story.
Native Americans in Washington state face opioid and fentanyl overdose rates four times the national average. Leaders are calling for more investment in treatment centers and transitional housing to address the problem. While nationally fentanyl overdoses have declined, Native American fatalities have surged since the pandemic. Representative Deborah Lekanoff is part of the state tribal opioid fentanyl task force. She serves Whatcom County, where overdose-related fatalities are the highest in the state.
I can't tell you the number of times that the Native American communities of Lummi Nation and of the Nooksack tribe have stood next to their graves, being in such sadness from the loss of their grandmothers, their mothers, their children.
During the task force's third annual summit, tribal leaders and state agencies met for 3 days and heard from community members in recovery from opioid use disorder. Last year, says Lekanoff, the task force partnered with tribal governments and invested in substance abuse treatment facilities based on a successful model created by the Swinomish.
The model that Swinomish created 12 years ago has now been incorporated into over 20 20 tribally owned substance abuse disorder facilities that are healing all Washingtonians.
Lekhanov says in the next couple of years, the task force will focus on transitional housing for those recovering from substance abuse. She says this is a nonpartisan issue and it will take everyone working together to make change.
It is going to take us recognizing that we're one people, we're one family, we're one community in Washington State.
For Public News Service, I'm Isabel Charlet. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
Nearly 6 months into his second presidential term, Donald Trump continues to falsely claim the 2020 election was stolen from him and has called for a special prosecutor to investigate. The Federal Bureau of Investigation director recently claimed his office has new evidence, but an election law expert says proof must involve actions, not social media posts. Roz Brown has more on the story.
President Donald Trump has renewed calls for a special prosecutor to probe false claims of fraud in the 2020 election, but an election expert believes it's likely just a new effort to raise funds. Earlier this month, FBI Director Kash Patel posted on social media that he'd found new evidence that implicates the Chinese Communist Party in 2020 election interference. David Becker leads the Center for Election Innovation and Research.
If the FBI has evidence of a crime, what they don't do is announce it on social media. They don't send it up to the Senate to do further investigation. If the FBI has evidence of a crime, they investigate, they indict, and prosecute. We are not seeing that here.
Despite dozens of lawsuits filed in the aftermath of the 2020 election, no federal judges cited a need to delay certification of the results. And the U.S. Supreme Court rejected an appeal brought by several Republican-led states to overturn the outcome. Trump's insistence of voter fraud contributed to 1,500 of his supporters storming the U.S. Capitol on January 6, 2021. Many were convicted of crimes, but were ultimately pardoned on Trump's first day in office. Friday night, the Justice Department fired at least three prosecutors involved in the Capitol riot case. Becker says firings in the agency are worrisome.
If you normalize this reshaping of the entire federal civil service and key agencies based solely upon loyalty, that is soon going to become the new normal, and we're going to see it done by both parties, and that will be to the detriment of us as Americans.
One of the biggest proponents of the myth that the 2020 election was stolen was MyPillow founder Mike Lindell, recently found guilty of defamation by a Denver jury. Lindell claimed Dominion voting systems manipulated voting machines to favor Joe Biden and called a former employee a traitor. Becker says Lindell is one of many who've made huge claims without concrete evidence.
It is easy to grandstand on the steps of a courthouse or on social media, but every single time they've been asked to put up or shut up in a court of law where their evidence would be subjected to scrutiny, they have shut up.
This is Roz Brown, New Mexico News Connection.
Climate change could take a bite out of the banana industry. Dr. Anthony Elizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Elizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Americans are bananas for bananas. People slice them into cereal, fry them with pancakes, and bake them into bread, making bananas one of the most popular fruits in the nation. But a new study warns that climate change threatens the global banana industry. Most bananas sold in the U.S. come from Latin American countries like Costa Rica and Colombia. As the climate warms, these countries may no longer be optimal locations for growing the fruit.
Places like the tropics, which are already very, very hot, are becoming hotter.
Dan Beber, an ecologist at the University of Exeter in the UK, co-authored the study. He says adapting by moving the industry to other parts of Latin America may be difficult. Growing bananas requires people to work on banana plantations, water to irrigate banana plants, and ports to ship bananas all over the world.
The regions that will be most suitable in terms of climate will actually be further away from ports. They may not be as well supplied with irrigation, and they may not have the people there to work in those regions. These other factors are going to constrain the industry's ability to adapt.
So global warming could take a bite out of the banana industry. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
By using wealth to create a practical and compassionate solution to homelessness, this millionaire is setting an example of what it really means to live a rich life and leave a great legacy. Mandy Stapleford has more on this story.
It's time now for your good news for a good planet. 99 tiny homes. When Canadian millionaire Marcel Lebrun saw homelessness on the rise in his hometown of Fredericton, New Brunswick, he decided to put his money to good use. The former tech executive spent a year studying homeless outreach programs across Canada and the United States. He then bought a plot of land and began constructing 12 Neighbors, a gated community of 99 tiny homes aimed at providing affordable, safe, and stable housing for the homeless. Despite initial skepticism and bureaucratic roadblocks, Lebrun persevered, garnering local support while pouring $4 million of his own fortune into the project and securing government grants totaling $12 million. Each little house has a kitchen, bathroom, living room, bedroom, a small deck, and solar panels. Rent includes utilities and internet service and is calculated based on income. In addition, the community offers counseling and employment opportunities to residents who contribute to the neighborhood's maintenance and construction of new homes. Lebrun is also building a resident-run community center with a coffee shop, a teaching kitchen, a silk printing business, and giving residents even more opportunities to thrive. By using his wealth to create a practical and compassionate solution to homelessness, this millionaire is setting an extraordinary example of what it really means to live a rich life and leave a great legacy too. And this is Mandy from GoodNewsGoodPlanet.com.
This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-801-1378. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Josh Salem and me, Dave Johnson. The producer is Hannah Francis, and our engineer is Sherry Meredith. Special thanks to Ken Jones, Alex Gonzalez, Antonia Gonzalez, Isabel Charlet, and Roz Brown. The interim evening news director is Hannah Francis. A podcast of tonight's newscast is available at our website at kboo.fm.